This morning, we are privileged to have Judge Ripple and I are privileged to have Judge Amy St. Eve of the District Court sitting with us.
Thank you, Judge Rofer. It's certainly an honor and a privilege to be here.
She's very tough. Okay. So, the first case for argument today is 09-1723 and 09-2107, Roe versus Aaliyah. And it's Mr. Heller, isn't it?
It is.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. This is an unusual case from what we read in the advance sheets. It's not a summary judgment case, and there was a verdict for a civil rights plaintiff. So in that regard, it is somewhat different than what we see. It's also different in that the trial judge vacated most of the plaintiff's verdicts and entered judgment for the defendants. And I'm suggesting that where the court went awry in his analysis is twofold. Number one, in substituting his judgment for the jury, he found that three of the plaintiffs had not proven that the defendant was deliberately indifferent to their case. If you look at the judge's order, however, where he's talking about why the jury awarded such a large punitive damage amount, Judge Baker finds that the doctor is dismissive, that the jury was in disgust of this policy that he had adopted. And he said that his conduct in devising this policy does support an award of punitive damages. He personally devised the policy, which a juror could infer, amounted to reckless indifference to the serious medical needs of inmates like Roe. Why just Roe? He devised a policy which intentionally, not just because it happened that way, wouldn't treat people who had Hep C. It was designed intentionally to avoid giving treatment to people with Hep C. So what if he didn't know their names? The fact that he didn't know that the person who wasn't getting treatment was Walker or Stevens or Stasiak, so what? He did it intentionally. He knew it would deprive people. That's why he devised the policy. He said in cross-examination, I've got this policy. I don't want to treat them all, but if I come up with something that doesn't treat anybody, it'll look pretty fishy.
Now, Mr. Heller, all the plaintiffs seem to have weak evidence of causation. What?
I'm sorry? Weak evidence of causation of the disease itself?
What is the best evidence in the record that Dr. Elias' policy caused them harm? Most or all of them also abused alcohol, which also causes cirrhosis.
We're not suggesting that the policy caused the hepatitis C. Each of these people had hepatitis C, whether they had it pre-existing, whether they got it from tattooing in prison.
Forgive me, that's not quite my question. My question is that it caused them harm.
The federal guidelines point out, Judge, that, and that's the other point, I was going to get to that, the other point of what the judge missed. And that is, these folks have a serious disease that is potentially fatal. And the antiviral treatment is not the only component of treatment, but that's what everybody seems to focus on. Dr. Aaliyah said, we're not going to give these people counseling. And the federal guidelines recommended that when you're diagnosed with a disease that may be fatal, you're supposed to give them counseling so that they learn how to deal with the disease.
Let's put this a little bit more specifically, maybe. What evidence do you have that any of your clients could not have waited until after their release date? What evidence do you have that their injury was caused by the fact that they were not treated while they were incarcerated?
Well, Eddie's dead. Eddie Rowe died.
I know, he is not.
He died, he didn't make the second day of trial and died shortly after trial. What's to say the rest of these folks aren't going to die too? I mean, if you have a fatal disease, aren't you harmed by the failure to treat it in and of itself?
What does the evidence show about the course of when this antiviral treatment actually works for hepatitis C patients. At what point in the course of the progression of the disease does the antiviral treatment work for hepatitis C patients?
The guidelines and Dr. Ilya both testified that the earlier a person gets treatment, the more likely it is to be effective. They also testified, and the guidelines support the proposition, that the treatment depends upon the genotype of the hepatitis C. And one of the things of treatment is to find out what genotype it is so you know what course of treatment to give them or if they even need urgent treatment. And the department didn't even test the genotype. They took the blood, but they didn't test it. And the reason they didn't test it is because they didn't want to know, because if it was treatable, then they'd have to treat it.
Mr. Heller, help me out with something that wasn't clear to me, at least in the record, but and it might be, I think, important to us. What is really the correlation between viral load and the degree of progression of this disease? How does a physician tell at what degree of progression this disease has gotten? Is it from viral load, or does he have to do a biopsy to know?
The viral load will give you an indirect indication as to what's going on. If, for example, the viral load disappears, then you know that the patient is either in remission, either by natural consequences or by the treatment. So the viral load tells you whether it's effective. As long as the viral load is abnormal, that the person is having disease symptoms. Everyone agrees, the guidelines and Dr. Ilya, that to know at what point the person is in terms of cirrhosis, in terms of imminent danger, you have to do a biopsy. And none of these people even got the biopsy except for Walker, and that was only after his deposition was taken and somebody realized, oh, my God, he's got 14 years now, left. And
now, suppose, and I agree, this is a supposition,
okay.
I understand, your client had been given a liver biopsy and then told that in the professional judgment of the prison physician, he could wait until after his release date for treatment. Would that be a different case than we have?
Absolutely.
Why?
Well, I think the case law is clear that deliberate indifference is different than malpractice. If the doctor had said, based on everything I see, it's my professional opinion that you can wait, you don't need it right now. And even if he's wrong, the cases say, okay. But as Judge Baker points out in the post-trial motion, he didn't do that. He said to his doctors, if they have Hep C, don't treat them. And if they file a grievance, deny it.
But what was it, Mr. Heller, about that policy that actually caused their ultimate injury here?
The fact that that policy automatically delays or denies them treatment for the Hep C. It automatically prevents them from getting it, whether they needed it or not.
You didn't have any medical evidence or experts on causation, did you?
Well, other than Dr. Ilya, who agreed, and the guidelines, both of which talk about causation and...
So that's your evidence of causation, the guidelines themselves?
And Dr. Ilya's testimony. He admitted, with the exception of the fact that he disagreed that 10 to 15% of these people would die, he agreed with the rest of the statistics in the guidelines, and the guidelines are pretty clear that...
What about the fact that the guidelines themselves say that only 10 to 15% of persons with the infection develop significant long-term complications? How does that affect your causation argument?
I don't think it does. That's like saying if the guards are playing Russian roulette with the prisoners, and that's what we liken it to with the jury. The fact that there's only a 16% chance that you'll be killed doesn't change the fact that you're
exposed. It's not killed, it's long-term complications.
Well, the long-term complications are cirrhosis of the liver, meaning you need a liver replacement, which are not readily available, or liver cancer, or other diseases which tend to be fatal.
You know, for patients who could benefit from the shorter course of treatment, patients like Mr. Rowe.
Sure.
The state pointed out in its brief that the guidelines seem to have changed a few times during they changed about the appropriate or needed course of treatment a few times. So if indeed the state is correct, how can we fault Dr. Aliyah for choosing a policy that allowed a longer time to address relapse and other issues?
First, the only two sets of guidelines that we dealt with at the trial were the 03 and the 05 guidelines. There was no significant change in the timing of treatment between those two items. Now, Dr. Aliyah tried to claim that the part of the guidelines that he was following was for pretrial detainees. And the guidelines say right in them, pretrial detainees are people who haven't been brought to trial, and the reason we're not going to apply them is we don't know how long they're going to be here. And Judge Baker made a comment on the record that said a sentenced prisoner is a totally different animal than a pretrial detainee. A pretrial detainee might bail out the next day. And so there is a difference between someone who might be there 2 weeks and someone who we know is going to be there 2 years. But the guidelines didn't really change in terms of saying we need to find out what the situation is in terms of the disease. We need to refer them for psychological counseling. We need to give them education to learn how to deal with this disease. And we need to have a specialist decide whether or not they're candidates for treatment. And none of that happened to any of these people.
Can you respond to that claim that Mr. Rowe's treatment was delayed by treatment for tuberculosis?
I knew Eddie through the entire time of this case. I had no indication that he had tuberculosis. He was in and out. He was out of prison for a while and then went back in. But I'm certainly not aware. And I don't recall any testimony at trial about tuberculosis. There was testimony on a lot of these folks about alcohol consumption or drug consumption. But the one thing that was pointed out on cross-examination from Dr. Aliyah was his suggestion was, well, these people drink alcohol and you shouldn't do that when you're getting treatment. The one time they wouldn't have access to alcohol or illicit drugs is while they're in jail. That would be the best time to treat these folks, not the worst.
Could I return to the area that Judge St. Eve was asking about? Throughout the litigation, in reviewing it, I was concerned that the district court may have been treating this Federal Bureau of Prisons policy as really setting a constitutional minimum. It isn't necessarily the constitutional minimum. It's the policy that federal prisons are following. Did the district court get those two standards mixed up?
I don't think so. I think that the standard that the Federal Bureau of Prisons issued is a guideline to the state courts as to what would be an appropriate manner of treatment. And I think what we looked at it as was a standard, just like you would in a medical malpractice case, a benchmark, if you will, but not a constitutionally mandated minimum. But what the judge found, and I think what the jury found and what they told you was that this policy was so deliberately indifferent that the jury was mad at Dr. Aliyah, and the judge was mad, and the judge found that this policy did amount to a deliberate indifference in reviewing it.
Mr. Heller, I'm sorry, did you just say that the guideline, the federal guideline that was used here, was not a constitutionally mandated minimum?
I did.
If that's the case, then did Dr. Aliyah have fair warning that what was at issue here was unconstitutional under the qualified immunity analysis?
I think he did.
And what was that fair warning to him?
Well, there had been hepatitis C cases decided 10, 15, 18. I mean, this isn't a brand new item. The issue of treating patients for hepatitis C has been in the federal courts 1991, as I recall.
That may be the case, but I don't think that's the question, not the hepatitis C itself. I think the question is, did the conduct at issue here clearly violate an established constitutional right? And if it did, what is that constitutional right if it's not what I thought you were arguing, the federal guidelines?
The standard and the way the jury was instructed was that the Eighth Amendment is incorporated into the prison, a cruel and unusual punishment, if the medical treatment amounts to a deliberate indifference to a serious medical disease.
But you've got Dr. Ilya largely following the federal guidelines for hepatitis C care, and he varied the policy for administrative cost and, I guess, consistency reasons. How was he on notice that his conduct violated the law?
With all due respect, his policy did not follow the guidelines at all. He didn't send these people to a specialist. He didn't give them education. He didn't determine the genotype. And he didn't give anybody treatment unless he just absolutely had to. And he knew, by his own admission, that the reason he was doing it was to save money. It wasn't. He had absolutely no regard for his prisoners. The only thing he cared about was saving $30 million a year. That was it.
Well, let's go through these gentlemen. Mr. Stasiak, his numbers were sometimes up, sometimes his numbers were down. And the federal policy did not clearly advise a procedure in those circumstances.
He was
so without his own expert to say what the standard of care should have been for him, it's hard to call Dr. Ilya deliberately indifferent as to him.
I disagree, because while they were up and down, they were always more than twice the normal limit. He was always at risk. He had the viral process going on. He did not get education. He did not get counseling. He did not get a liver biopsy. He didn't even get genotype testing so that we could tell whether he could be treated in 12 weeks or whether he needed 48 weeks of care. But we know one thing. He wasn't one of the 85% who went into remission on his own, because he had viral loads on each of his testings. So to say that he didn't have any harm is just not true, and the fact that he should have been treated is not true either. But
the federal guidelines say if the ALT levels are less than twice the normal, which I think is what you're arguing here they were in 2003, that 6 months later you should be retested. And the evidence presented in the district court was that in August of 2004, Stasiak's ALT level had dropped. And so he was no longer, 6 months later, following the federal guidelines, his levels were no longer where they had been in 2003, suggesting he did not require treatment under the federal policy.
No, actually, I think while they had dropped, I think they were still more than two times the
I don't believe that's what the evidence showed.
The other problem, of course, is that he had had elevated enzymes more than twice for a long period of time. And the testimony was fairly clear that if an acute hepatitis C infection is going to resolve, it will resolve acutely within 6 to 8 weeks, and if it doesn't, then it's considered chronic. And I guess that was the other part of the policy that we didn't talk much about. But Dr. Ilya would not follow up so that instead of 6 months, he might go a year between testings. And that, of course, widens the window. If you don't test the person for 6 months and then you make him wait another 6 months and then make him have 18 months of a sentence left before you do anything, you're now at 2.5 years, and the testimony was that the average length of person would stay in DOC was between 18 and 24 months, so that you, by adopting a 28-month window, you effectively exclude by far and away the majority of the people that are going to come through the institution, and you don't have to care for them.
Mr. Helper, the others, the state indicates what two other states of the union do in the situations like this. What do the other 47 states do? We know what Illinois does, and the two states Illinois has told us about. What do the others do?
California has been through the suit, and I mean they were doing the same thing, and they were sued, and the courts have stepped in, and they're now following the federal guidelines. I suspect, without a survey, that we would find that, with the exception, I think it's Minnesota and maybe Wisconsin, I would suspect that most prudent administrators would say, hey, wait a minute, the Federal Bureau of Prisons gives us this guideline for a reason. Maybe that ought to be the minimum level of care that we give to our... It's no different than a hospital standard in a medical malpractice case. It's not an absolute, but it certainly is some evidence of what the standard of care ought to be.
But if other states were following the same policy that Illinois had, how could Dr. Elia have been on fair notice that his conduct was unconstitutional?
Well, because there had been a case in California that said that doing exactly what Dr. Elia was doing was unconstitutional.
When was that case?
Well, that was about 4 years before this case started.
Was that introduced into the record? Was that evidence of California and what happened there introduced into the record?
Whether that...
If you remember.
We argued that issue on many occasions in the district court, and we cited cases around the United States. Whether that exact case was cited or not, I can't tell you. But the issue of qualified immunity was before Judge Baker on a number of occasions.
You see, one hurdle here is Dr. Elliott's testimony was the only testimony on the standard of care. And it's hard to say that the policy that he was following was so outside the standard of care that it could not be an exercise of professional judgment.
Well, first of all, it's not a standard of care case, so it's different in that regard.
Well,
but I mean, if you look at Judge Baker's...
I have to differ with you. Of course, standard of care is part and parcel of this case.
If you look at Judge Baker's ruling on the post-trial motion, he specifically makes a finding that, in fact, the devising this policy supports an award of punitive damages and is, in fact,
But I don't think Judge Rovner's question was a punitives question. It were still on the qualified immunity, and standard of care would be a baseline for Dr. Elia to determine what was and wasn't constitutional.
You're right. But standard of care is an easier burden to get over than deliberate indifference. That's what I'm suggesting. Judge Baker says it's a reckless indifference to the serious medical needs of the inmates. He's finding that it's even worse than deliberate. It's reckless. And Elia testified it was intentional. So we're saying that this is worse than a standard of care. This is clearly a malpractice case, but because under the Eighth Amendment we have to show deliberate indifference, we're suggesting that it's worse than a violation of standard of care. It's a deliberate indifference.
Now, you know you're into your rebuttal. Do you want to save some time?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Ms. Welsh.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. There are two issues before the court today. One is the plaintiff's appeal, and the other is our appeal. I think first we need to discuss the jurisdictional question, unless the court has no questions about the jurisdictional question as to plaintiff's appeal.
Sure. What effect does a federal rule of appellate procedure 4A have on your claim that we lack jurisdiction?
Well, if you...
The plaintiff's appeal. I mean, does it matter that they filed the notice early? Does it matter that they filed it before the court ruled on all the post-trial motions? And I'm excluding from my question the appeal of the punitive damages award because Roe has conceded he may not appeal the remitter. But does Rule 4A save the other three plaintiffs' appeal?
I believe not, Your Honor, because if you look at 4A, 4B, Small Roman numeral 2, which specifically addresses the a post-judgment motion. What it says is that when you're challenging disposition of a motion to alter or amend that has been successful, that has resulted in an altered or amended judgment, the party must file the notice of appeal in the time prescribed, measured from the entry of the order disposing of that motion. Now, the order disposing of that motion was the March 24th order. Until then, there was this conditional remitter And the district court alerted plaintiff to the fact that that order, the original, the February 18th and 19th orders, were not final and not appealable.
Ms. Welsh, yet, wouldn't your argument only apply to Plaintiff Rowe, because the original ruling on the post-trial motions by the district court judge was final as to the other plaintiffs?
But you can't be final to some and not to others. You can only be final if you're final to everybody.
Is there a law or a rule that governs that?
You don't have a final judgment until it disposes of all the claims with all the parties. And so, I mean that's Rule 4. And so until you have a rule that completely disposes of all claims and with all parties, and all that's left is to enforce a judgment, then you don't have a final judgment.
Look, 4A2 provides, quote, filing before entry of judgment, a notice of appeal filed after the court announces a decision or order, but before the entry of the judgment or order, is treated as filed on the date of and after the entry. Doesn't that take care of filing too early?
Well, no, that covers the period between when you have an announced final judgment. For example, if a judge says, I'm granting summary judgment for the plaintiff and I'll get to my judgment later, you know, the Rule 58 judgment. So the Supreme Court has been very clear about this. You can't, a notice of appeal filed before you could have a Rule 58 judgment is not effective. So the rule you were talking about, Judge Rovner, is when there could have been a Rule 58, but it just hasn't been delayed, like when the district court issues a memorandum opinion, and then 5 days later, or a month later, or 180 days later, there is the Rule 58 judgment. And remember, that's what Rule 4, you know, there's the Otis case and all of those cases where there was that problem. Like, what do you do if the court hasn't issued the Rule 58 judgment? Like, how do you know when you're supposed to appeal? When does your 30 days start? And so the rule you're talking about, Judge Rovner, addresses that.
District court specifically say this is not a final judgment as to all of these plaintiffs? I know the court said on the issue of punitives, you need to get back on this, but where did the district court say this is not final as to these plaintiffs?
Well, it kept saying in the judgments, in the orders entered after February 18th, it said, you know, the February 18th, 19th judgments are still in effect. So what it was saying was, I haven't issued a final judgment, and we know that from the March 23rd judgment when it finally said, I am issuing the remitted punitive judgment.
I don't understand. If the judge said these are still in effect, why that translates to they're not final?
Because it was, what was still in effect was the conditional remitter. And the conditional remitter, as the district court noted in its March 24th order, was not a final order by its very nature. A conditional order isn't final.
Well, let's go on to the merits, because
I know it's a novel, certainly, system. But
getting your argument.
Before we do that, is our decision in Republic Tobacco consonant with the decisions in the other circuits?
I believe so. I don't recall that there's a difference. Certainly, the plaintiffs have never countered the argument that their notice of appeal was not timely under this court's or any court's jurisprudence. It was a noticeable omission in their reply brief. But turning, as the court has suggested, to the merits, with regard to if there is jurisdiction as to the three plaintiffs, and there is certainly jurisdiction as to Roe, then the question is, was there, and the court has recognized this as they're talking, was there enough evidence to show?
Can you say there certainly is jurisdiction as to Roe?
As to our appeal with regard to Roe.
Oh, okay.
Yes, sorry. Yeah, no, not with the punitives. The plaintiffs have conceded that there's no jurisdiction as to the remitter appeal. I'm sorry. But even before you get to the evidence, the court, I think, has identified the qualified immunity problem here, which, of course, it can address first now. It doesn't have to go through the violation, the Saussure analysis. So in qualified immunity, as we pointed out in our brief, there were three states, North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, and New York, all of which had policies that were similar or longer than ours.
And was that before the district court? I couldn't tell from the record if you had presented that argument to the district court.
We had certainly presented the qualified immunity argument, yes.
Yes, I understand that, but in particular that three other states had the same policy. Did you present that evidence and that argument to the district court?
I think we relied more on the guidelines, that there wasn't a substantial departure from the guidelines.
Okay, and I know that argument was there. I couldn't tell if you told the district court at the time Dr. Elia was doing this, three other states had a similar policy.
I don't know that we told the district court that explicitly, but certainly the plaintiff never came up when the district court...
I mean, look, it's either there or it isn't. Did you do it?
I'm sorry?
It's either... I mean, we're going to have to, you know...
Right. I'll be happy to go back and check.
We're going to have to go back.
Right. I mean, I'll be happy to go back and check our...
Your record looking for this.
Right. I mean, I'll be happy to go back and check our filings to see if we identified these particular things. But again, I mean...
did, within 10 days, can
yes, certainly,
let
Your
us by letter know where?
Certainly, Your Honor.
So we're not... sniffling through the hole.
I'd be happy to, Your Honor.
Looking for...
Right, but again, remember that on and we brought that up even though we don't have the burden. On qualified immunity, the plaintiff has the burden to show that we were on, as the court mentioned, that there was fair warning to us. We pointed out that there wasn't fair warning, but that wasn't even our
burden.
Certainly, if
you're asking this court, the Seventh Circuit, to consider the three states, it should have been before the district court as well.
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor, only because, again, this court can affirm on any ground in the record. And
not in the record. Is it in the record?
On qualified immunity being in the record.
We can't make up arguments for you. We can't pull North Dakota.
Right, but again, Your Honor, I believe that at the very least, the plaintiff had to show that there was some kind of fair warning to us that the policy here was unconstitutional, was such a substantial deviation from the standard of from the general standard of care that it was unconstitutional. And I think we know, for example, from Mr. Stasiak's own experience when he was released, he testified that he was told he had to wait 8 to 12 months for a biopsy. And if in the outside world you have to wait 8 to 10 months for a biopsy, it certainly you can't say that there's deliberate indifference and surely not that there's not qualified immunity if the standard of care here would be that you have 6 months, everybody agrees, 6 months for testing, you have to have twice over 6 months, double, you have to have two times, twice the normal, elevated levels.
In Roe's case.
Yes.
Roe had a diagnosis.
Correct, quite early.
He had a genotype.
Correct.
What more had to be done before he could have a biopsy?
Well, Your Honor, again, because he had been out, he came back in 04, January of 04. But then, as Judge Rover noted, he was misdiagnosed with tuberculosis, which is in his medical records, which we cite in our brief. In Exhibit 1, which is his medical records. And he was told that he could not have, and he testified to this, he was told that he could not have treatment for hepatitis C while he was being treated for tuberculosis. We don't know. There's no evidence in the record to support that you could have a biopsy or that it would be telling if you were on tuberculosis. Again, this is one of the problems with the plaintiff's case. There's no medical evidence here to support their claim. And again, because then after 2 months, keep in mind, 2 months after That was the first 2 months of that nine-month period in 2004 that the plaintiff was, that Mr. Rowe was incarcerated. So then there were only 7 months left to do not just a biopsy, but it's a six-month period where you have to do a workup, you have to do the counseling, you have to find out if there are contraindications, which in Mr. Rowe's case, there was a history of alcohol abuse, which is a serious contraindication for hepatitis C treatment. So again, you'd have the six-month period for the biopsy and the workup, and then 6 months for his treatment. But that's 12 months, and he was only there 7 months after the tuberculosis treatment ended. So he couldn't fit in, even if the policy were different and said, okay, if you're a six-month person, you get to go ahead. You still need 12 months, 6 months for the biopsy, 6 months for the treatment. And that's even if you'd say we don't have to redo your enzyme levels to see if they're consistent, because as the court knows, everybody's enzyme levels moved up and down. In fact, contrary to what the counsel said, each of the plaintiffs' ALT levels was not double. Mr. Walker's was 61. That's just barely over the 55, which is the top of the range. And that was in October of 2004. Mr. Stasiak's was 53, which was within the normal range. And that was in August of 2004. And Mr. Stevens, although he was... his levels were elevated for long enough, he was only there 7 months, the same length of time that Mr. Rowe was in, and so that meant he didn't have 6 months for the biopsy workup and so on genotyping, and if he turned out to have the genotype that could allow it, which again is under 30%, so it's more likely that he is not in the genotype that would allow the 6 month treatment the 6 month treatment as opposed to the 12 month treatment.
Ms. Welsh, when the district court said there was no serious dispute that hepatitis C was a serious medical condition, did you object? Did you ask for a curative instruction? Did you ask for a mistrial?
Well, Your Honor, during the jury instructions. This was at the very outset of the trial. And you'll notice that in his closing, plaintiff's counsel capitalized on this misstep of the district court and said, well, the district court told you there's no real dispute about whether this is a serious medical condition. And, you know, I know that the defendant disagrees. Well, that's telling the jury, if you don't find that this is a serious medical condition, you're going against the court. I mean, that's the kind of thing that can lead to unfairness in a verdict.
But did you object?
That was my question.
Yes, it can lead to unfairness.
No, did you object?
No, we did not object at the time.
Well,
no.
Then, are you objecting now?
Yes, because it's fundamentally unfair to have the jury told by the district court that in effect, the plaintiff, without presenting any evidence, has satisfied one of the elements of his claim. And in fact, this was an incorrect statement, because although hepatitis C can be serious for some people, as the court remarked earlier, only 85% develop long-term complications. We don't know that any of these plaintiffs would have developed long-term complications because...
to object during trial?
Yes, Your Honor, it was.
Okay. I'm troubled by the district court inferring that medical director meant the facility medical director. This is in Walker's case, I think, only, as opposed to the agency medical director.
Well,
because, of course, that seems to be construing the facts in favor of the defendant. Why would a jury be compelled to find that medical director meant something other than agency medical director? You know, Huffman was a witness under your control. Why didn't you have him testify who he meant?
First, Your Honor, that wasn't our evidence. I mean, we didn't know that they were going to, I guess we didn't realize that they were going to spin it this way, but there are two reasons why the jury couldn't believe that Huffman meant the medical director of the agency. One is that when Huffman was talking about Dr. Alia, he called him the agency medical director. And the second reason is that Dr. Alia testified that he did not have direct monitoring of any patient and any of the 44,000 inmates. So the only reasonable inference from Mr. Huffman in particular referring to the medical director, the only reasonable inference from that title would be that it had to be the prison medical director as opposed to the agency director, since Mr. Huffman distinguished between the two. And I would also point out that Mr. Stasiak called Dr. Alia the agency medical director in his own grievance. So it was a term of art that people use within the institutions.
The district court, here we have a district court saying that the only reasonable interpretation of the records is that they referred to the facility's medical director, not to Dr. Alia. So, in other words, what you've got is a district court construing a fact in Elia's favor, which I don't believe he's entitled to do, given the jury verdict.
Well, but he is when you look at the totality of the evidence, because when you see when you look at all the evidence, and you see how Mr. Huffman referred to Dr. Alia as the agency medical director, and also that Mr. Stasiak did, that this was the term that people used for Dr. Alia, agency medical director. They didn't call him
but
the medical
director. Huffman didn't testify what he meant when he wrote medical director, right. And there was testimony from others that Alia was the medical director. What you're arguing, I think a jury could certainly come away with that inference, but this is post-trial, and the judge is supposed to be taking all inferences in the most favorable light to the non-moving party.
But it has to be reasonable. I don't think there was any evidence. I don't recall any evidence in the record where Dr. Alia was referred to just as the medical director. He was the agency medical director. That's what Huffman himself referred to him in two other memos. So if Huffman's nomenclature is being relied on, and his nomenclature is shown to differ when it's referring to Dr. Alia.
But he didn't say what his nomenclature for medical director was. I think that's what the problem
right. Is.
If he had testified, when I say medical director, I'm only referring to A, I would accept your argument. But he didn't define that nomenclature. And moreover, the plaintiff testified that his grievances did go all the way to Dr. Alia. So when you have those two facts, can the district court take the other inference, or take the inference that it did?
No, it, with regard to that second fact, I mean, even though Walker testified that his grievances went all the way to Leah, the court disregarded that evidence because he didn't have any firsthand knowledge. There are no notations by Dr. Leah on his grievances. There's no evidence in the record from anybody with firsthand knowledge that his grievances went to Dr. Alia. And again, Mr. Huffman's memo said the medical director is monitoring his care. Now, again, we have to remember when he was talking about Dr. Alia, we know on two other occasions he used the term agency medical director because that's the term of art for the person in Dr. Alia's position. And in addition, Dr. Alia testified, I don't monitor individual patients. I don't have anything to do with individual patients. And that's what that memo said. The medical director is monitoring, you. And so it had to mean, the only reasonable inference is that it meant that he, that it was the prison medical director, not the agency director. But Mr. Walker, I think we know two things here, just to sort of clarify this. Both Mr. Stasiak and Mr. Stephen didn't present evidence of their genotype, so they never presented evidence that they could be treated within 6 months. And they also never presented evidence that even if they could be treated within 6 months, they were in custody for the 12 months it would have taken for the 6 months for the workup and the 6 months for the treatment.
Okay, but so, Walker,
so Mr. Walker
was in prison long enough so that the two-year policy shouldn't have affected him. I mean, even by Dr. Aaliyah's standards, he should have been treated.
Correct. So Dr. Aaliyah's policy was not the cause of his not being treated. According to Dr. Aaliyah, the cause of his not being treated was that the medical director, that is to say the prison medical director, did not tell Dr. Aaliyah that Mr. Walker was eligible for a liver biopsy. And we know that Mr. Walker wasn't eligible for a liver biopsy
but I really may have missed something, but I didn't see where anyone had an explanation for why he was not treated. His records, of course, indicate that the medical director was following his case.
Correct. The prison medical director. And keep in mind that his ALT level was 61 in October of 04. So he didn't have an ALT level that was high enough. It wasn't double. The range was 0 to 55, so you had to be at 110. His was only at 61, so he wasn't even eligible for a biopsy, much less treatment. So, again, there had to be, you know, for Mr. Walker to have liability with regard to Dr. Aaliyah, he had to show that Dr. Aaliyah was responsible for the delay in his treatment. And he didn't show it through the policy because under the policy, he should have been treated. So it wasn't the policy
that
was the cause.
You're arguing both things now. You're saying he wasn't eligible for treatment because his levels were low, but Dr. Aaliyah admitted during his testimony he was eligible, and
no.
You just said that.
No, he was eligible he fell outside the policy because he was there for more than 2 years. So if he could have been treated if he had had the high enough ALT levels for a biopsy, and if his biopsy had showed fibrosis and inflammation, as the guidelines suggest, sufficient to require treatment, because going back to the guidelines tell us that just because you're eligible for a biopsy doesn't mean that you're eligible for treatment. The biopsy has to show that you have both inflammation and fibrosis at a certain level. If not, then you get another biopsy in another year or more, depending on the level of fibrosis and the level of inflammation.
Well,
so
it's not a reason to stay out of prison.
But on the other hand, if you are in prison, if you have the ALT levels that require a biopsy, if your biopsy shows that you require treatment and you're going to be there for a long enough period for the treatment to finish, then you're going to be treated, unlike, say, Mr. Stevens, who testified, I wasn't able to get a biopsy for 8 to 12 months. Here, the policy is designed so that you would get your biopsy within that 6 months. So going back to the notion several things, to sum up, if I may, this policy did not deviate, was not shown to deviate from the guidelines, and it certainly, qualified immunity tells us that it doesn't deviate from other states. And Dr. Aaliyah did testify that he consulted other states' prisons to find out what their policies were. Neither Mr. Walker nor Mr. Stasiak was able to show that they had high enough levels of ALT to support to require a biopsy and thus not to require treatment. Mr. Stasiak had high enough levels, but he was only in for 7 months, and so he wasn't there for the 6 months for the biopsy and 6 months for treatment, even if he had showed he had the genotype, which neither Mr. Walker nor Mr. Stasiak nor Mr. Stevens was able to show. And as for Mr. Rowe, he also was there for only 7 months, not long enough for a biopsy and 6 months of treatment. So we ask that the court affirm the judgment for Dr. Aaliyah and against Mr. Walker, Mr. Stasiak, and Mr. Stevens, But if the court reverses, then we ask the court to remand for the courts to address the new trial. And we also ask that the court reverse the judgment as to Mr. Rowe, and if not, to order a new trial. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Walsh. Mr. Heller, how many minutes? You have 3 minutes.
Thank you.
Would you please address the jurisdictional issue at some point during your 3 minutes?
Yes, ma'am. I'll do that right off. I don't think there's any question but that the order of Judge Baker was absolutely clear as to the three defendants who he reversed for, that he entered judgment against them, and the notice of appeal was filed thereafter. There was nothing equivocal about that. No invitation for them to do anything further. He entered judgment against them in favor of Dr. Ilya and actually awarded costs. So I do believe that under Rule 4 it was timely. The interesting argument of counsel is that nobody made that argument at trial. The first time we saw this weighing of ALT levels was in the judge's post-trial motion. He made that weighing a fact. They didn't argue to the jury, hey, ladies and gentlemen, their argument to the jury was simply, I've got this policy. And speaking of policies, if three other states say it's okay, that means you have qualified immunity. If Texas, Florida, and Louisiana decide they'll kill people that have AIDS instead of treating them, does that make it okay? I mean, that seems to be the argument. We're going to let these
state would have to have would be three other malefactors and sign a pact with the devil and tie up the federal courts.
When you consider that Wexford is providing the medical care in probably 37 states, that shouldn't be very hard to do, especially in light of the fact, and it's in this record, that the medical director for the state of Illinois Department of Corrections was in prison, had been put in prison just months before this trial for taking bribes from Wexford. So is it surprising that we're dealing with this situation?
Are you mixing apples and oranges there?
I don't think so. I think it was clear that there was a monetary reason for adopting this policy, and that's what it wasn't about. Well, we're really providing great care. We're doing better than if these guys go out and are on public aid, which is what counsel was arguing to you. That's not the test either. If these people can't afford it on the outside and it takes them 8 months to get on public aid, does that mean the prison can abdicate to that level? I have never seen a case that suggested that. We believe that the jury was accurately instructed, both as to punitive damages and to nominal damages, that they listened to the evidence, that they made a decision, and that the court should honor the decision of the jury. Therefore, Judge Baker should be reversed as it relates to the three non-Roe plaintiffs, and that the judgment should be reinstated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Heller, and thank you, Ms. Welsh. And the case will be taken under advisement.